The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes. Welcome to the Space Show, an hour of exploring new frontiers and exciting opportunities in outer space. Here's your host, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Sunday Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston. It's a nice, beautiful, very warm day in Northern California, which is where the Space Show originates. It's great to have all of you here. Let me make a few quick announcements, and we'll get right into our guest, Jim McDade, who has been a frequent guest on the Space Show, and the subjects we want to talk about. Just reminders for those of you that would like to participate in our show today, you can call toll-free at 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Let the phone ring until we can answer it. And when you are answered, you are also on the air. You can also join the show today by using email dmlivings@yahoo.com or drspace@thespaceshow.com. And for those of you working with AOL's Instant Messenger, our screen name is Space Show Chat. Visit our website, thespaceshow.com. There you can subscribe to our newsletter. You can read the current one, which is posted every Monday. And you can also find out about exciting Space Show cool gear. Click on the button and see if there isn't something there that interests you. And all of our shows are archived there, so you have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week listening convenience for any and all of the Space Shows dating back about 2.5 years now. Our guest, as I said earlier, is Jim McDade, who has been on this program quite a few times and hopefully will continue to come on this program. Jim is the Director of Technology at the University of Alabama Birmingham Business and Engineering Complex, and he is also the founder and coordinator of Space ADG, which is an electronic newsletter and one of the very best that I receive. It's free. I urge all of you to go and subscribe to it. It is absolutely a must, a real keeper. Mr. McDade has his MIS degree from the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and he has written numerous articles and commentaries about space exploration for the Birmingham News, Inside Kennedy Space Center, television, radio, and other publications over the past several decades. He is also a former contributing editor for Space.com, and he has been a radio reporter and TV reporter and producer for State Public Television Network going back to the 1970s. He has met most of the men who walked on the moon. He has interviewed numerous participants in the space exploration program and witnessed many of the very important manned as well as unmanned launches from Kennedy. And he is extremely well connected with people who truly know what's going on in our space program, within NASA, within the government. And so let's talk to Jim McDade. Welcome to the show, Jim. And let's start out and see what you can tell us about this upcoming CAIB report about the horrible Columbia accident, which is due out on, I guess, Tuesday, correct?
Right, and thank you for the kind comments, David. And I want to say one of my most cherished relationships is the one I have with you, because this program is, there's nothing else in the world like it, and you're doing so much to help promote space exploration. And a year like this, where we've had such a terrible tragedy, your program has been sort of a shining light that you're helping keeping people interested and motivated when it comes to space exploration. I want to thank you a lot.
Well, thank you. And now if we can only get the Congress people and NASA administrators to listen to this show, we'll make some progress.
We need to pipe it into the halls of Congress and the White House. Well, the report coming out, it's a whopping 250 pages, so there's going to be a lot of red-eyed observers and journalists Tuesday morning when it comes out. Of course, Admiral Hal Gaiman is the chairman of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. It's now referred to as CABE for you people who want to use the insider terminology. The last few weeks, I've attended a couple of the press briefings, and I actually went to the inaugural public meeting of the Return to Flight Task Group that was held at Kennedy Space Center, and I signed on as a witness, and I was able to ask questions, interviewed Richard Covey, who, of course, is a co-chair, along with Tom Stafford, the Apollo and Gemini program astronaut veteran. And I also attended a briefing about human spaceflight and was able to question NASA Deputy Administrator Fred Gregory and the Associate Administrator for Spaceflight Bill Reedy and Brian O'Connor, who is responsible for safety and mission assurance, which, of course, is a critical topic that's going to be addressed in the accident investigation report. So it's going to be a difficult week, because I think this report is going to be very uncomfortable reading for some of the people whose names are either going to be directly or indirectly mentioned in this report. But the real fire may occur in Congress after this report comes out, because on September 4th, Admiral Gaiman is scheduled to be the first in a series of people who will testify before Congress. And naturally, this being a coming up on a presidential election and a very critical election for both parties, both of Republicans and Democrats, I just hope that NASA doesn't become a hapless political football in this deal.
Well, they may. And, I just got back from the Mars Society conference in Eugene, Oregon, and quite a few of the guest speakers, as well as Dr. Zubrin, who hosts this conference, spoke about the fact that it was their understanding that this report was really going to be brutal on NASA. And there is concern as to what type of reaction there will be regarding NASA and the space program among the general public when they get sound bites and one- or two-line headlines, and things get sort of distorted and misstated and misunderstood, which is what happens when you don't go into something very thoroughly, and you know that these 250 pages are not going to be gone into thoroughly by most news services, newspapers, or the general public. What do you think the reaction might be?
Well, a lot of people are, and when I say a lot of people, I've also interviewed, and we'll get into that a little later, Harrison Schmitt, of course, the only scientist who ever walked on the moon. He was the Apollo 17 lunar module pilot. And the old pad leader himself, Gunter Wendt, a man who was extremely thorough when it came to safety issues on the pad. He was there and strapped Alan Shepard into his Mercury capsule and worked all the way, I suppose, through the first 10 shuttle missions. But Gunter is really angry about what appears to be short institutional memory in NASA. And he had some interesting comments, as well as Harrison Schmitt. We'll get into those later. While I was down at Kennedy Space Center, Richard Covey, who, of course, like I said, very bravely commanded the return to flight following Challenger in 1986, I wasn't going to throw him softballs. I asked him, I said, look, most of us in the American public thought you guys fixed these safety problems the first time around after Challenger. And, now some people are saying that similar mistakes, that there are very similar patterns that are showing up in the STS-107 accident. And he really didn't have an answer to that other than to basically point out that, that's a different generation of people, and perhaps lessons were forgotten, and people really didn't perform up to the level that they should have been. But he really did not have a good answer to that question, and I think that's what the American public and the politicians are going to demand, to know why these lessons were forgotten and why NASA has no plan to remind its own people of these sorts of issues that can turn out to be deadly.
Well, I just am hoping and praying that the space program doesn't suffer great setbacks from the political side as well as the general public side, as if they need to cut funding or punish people or say, you know, we have no business in space, and this is an example of it. And so that it, you know, I know there is a real concern out there that there may be that type of backlash, and I know there's going to be hatchet job headlines all over the country once they get the taglines out of the CAIB report. You know, the press is going to probably have a field day with whatever they can put into sound bites and one or two dramatic words or phrases.
Well, the word that you keep hearing in the media already is culture, the organizational culture of NASA, and that will probably be in the headlines when this report comes out. As you know, the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, even though it really wasn't the independent board that you would ideally hope for in this situation, they did release 4 recommendations over the process of their work. And so we have a preview. We've been told there will be no major surprises in the report, but, you know, if we can quickly review those earlier recommendations. Recommendation 1, and I'll quote here, prior to return to flight, NASA should develop and implement a comprehensive inspection plan to determine the structural integrity of all reinforced carbon-carbon system components. That inspection plan should take advantage of non-destructive inspection technology. The second recommendation was that before shuttle returns to flight, NASA should modify its memorandum of agreement with the National Imagery and Mapping Agency, NIMA, to make ongoing orbit imaging for each shuttle flight a standard requirement. So those recommendations came out in April of this year. And then on June 27th, Recommendation 3 came out, which was basically that before return to flight to missions to the International Space Station, NASA should develop a practical capability to inspect and effect emergency repairs to the widest possible range of damage to that thermal protection system. And that on missions independent of the International Space Station, NASA needs the ability to inspect and repair on orbit, which would mean you're going to need the ability to have the astronauts go outside the shuttle and effect those repairs and possibly do a close-up eyeball inspection of the reinforced carbon-carbon. And there, they also insisted that this inspection be done early in all the missions, so that they will have the maximum time on orbit if it's necessary to effect a rescue mission or other operations that could save the crew's lives. Recommendation 3, the ultimate objective, according to NASA, should be a fully autonomous capability for all missions to address the possibility that an ISS mission does not achieve the necessary orbit, fails to dock successfully, or suffers damage during or after undocking. That's quoting. So basically, by autonomous, this means the shuttle itself is going to need to carry all of the supplies and equipment, both to make those inspections and effect repairs if possible. The 4th recommendation from CAIB came out on July 1st, and that regarded the imaging system that's used to provide views of the shuttle during launch from liftoff until SRB separation. And the CAIB would prefer that NASA use high-resolution images, and perhaps this would be live video that we could all watch. There just weren't enough good angles. There was not a good angle showing the impact area, and it was impossible to see the RCC panel from the orbiter, no matter how hard you craned your neck. The space shuttle doesn't have a rear-view mirror up there that allows the crew to look back and inspect that wing, but they may now. And NASA, in Recommendation 4, has also encouraged that they start using any available mobile assets, ships or aircraft, to provide additional angles and views of the craft during ascent. So that basically, we know that those recommendations are going to be included in the final report. And I have some ideas about what the CAIB report should focus on. This is sort of speculation, but would you like to hear those?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay, I think number 1, They should focus on the immediate cause of the tragedy. In the report, we never did really have that smoking gun, although an enthusiastic testing engineer in Houston said, this is the smoking gun, when they were able to fire the external tank TPS foam into that panel and crack it. Knocked a pretty large hole in it. But they should focus on explaining what they have determined to be the immediate cause of the tragedy, and so that the public and the politicians understand that NASA has made every effort to eliminate other possible causes, and of course that would fend off conspiracy theories and other issues that could cloud the issues. Number two, I think they need to examine the real-time response of NASA to the observed impact. That was after the engineers saw that initial video showing the TPS foam striking the orbiter. Harrison Schmidt told me that he was disappointed that the shuttle management team doesn't order the kind of full-up, offline mission anomaly response that was implemented during the Apollo program. We'll talk about Harrison's response a little later, but if you've seen the movie Apollo 13, that's a pretty accurate portrayal of how NASA handled unanticipated events or emergencies. They would create this offline response team that would go into the back rooms. They had access to computers and laboratories and simulators and whatever hardware that was identical to flight hardware that they needed to figure out a problem. Exactly what happened when, on another Apollo mission, on the next mission, Apollo 14, when, and many people may not recall this, but Apollo 14 was almost a failure because the docking mechanism on the Apollo spacecraft refused to engage when the crew attempted to pull the lunar module out of the Saturn V third stage. So that mission was almost not pulled off, and there was an offline response where engineers and managers put their heads together and tried to figure out what the problem was. The third item they need to focus on, and I think this is something that needs serious examination. I've written about it, and a number of authors have written about it, and that's just the overall troubled legacy of post-Apollo NASA, and particularly the space shuttle program. The space shuttle program suffers from the equivalent of fetal malnutrition and battered child syndrome. It was undernourished budget-wise from the very beginning. NASA only got about half of the dollars it told the White House and Congress it needed to build the shuttle. And then as soon as they started to build the shuttle, the axe kept coming down over and over. They kept reducing the budget, the development budget, which is the most critical budget of all, not the operational, so-called operational, although we've been told that the shuttle was still an experimental craft, but what happened with the shuttle was diametrically opposed to what happened with the Saturn series of rockets, where the Marshall Space Flight Center development team and the contractors who built the lunar module and the command module were basically given the funding they needed. NASA was the model of civilian program management in those days. It orchestrated the efforts of 410,000 people to pull off Apollo. And they came in on or under budget, which is unheard of today. So obviously the problem with NASA is not just that it's a huge government bureaucracy like other government bureaucracies, because they've shown the ability historically to manage 410,000 government and contractor employees and produce great work. So the problem is NASA has become, because of changes in policy, they've become more like the typical government bureaucracy. In the beginning, and Gunter Vent talked about this, and we will get into that more. In the beginning days, NASA was exempt from the typical civil service regulations and some of the red tape and other employment measures that were used by, say, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, IRS, and other government agencies that we've seen that underperformed with national security in the events surrounding 9/11. I think the final thing that NASA needs to do is in the CA or the CAIB needs to focus on in its report is go ahead and lay out what steps does NASA need to take in order to bring the shuttle program up to that level of safety and performance that astronauts, the families of the astronauts, American taxpayers, and NASA itself should be demanding. These recommendations should not be just vague. Well, NASA will strive to improve safety. They need to install in these recommendations some process for periodically reviewing NASA's progress toward improving safety in specific areas. Or we're going to just have another repeat of this incident after so many years. You know, David, the shuttle program was originally planned to last 12 years.
Right. And
100 missions, 12 years. It was based on an absurd cost benefits model of 60 flights a year to justify it, which was insane. But, you know, NASA needs to just back up and reevaluate this program. President Bush has already turned down the request for increased funding in the year 2004. NASA wanted, I think, $1.6 billion to bring the rest of the remaining three shuttles up to the safety levels that they desire, and they wanted, I think, $600 million of that or more was going to go to the orbital space plane project. But NASA just doesn't seem to have a clear idea of where it wants to go, and I want to see, you know, someone in the agency stand up and say, you know, it may be time to go ahead and look at retiring the shuttle earlier than we planned, because the shuttle was born with problems. Maybe it's time to look at the program and say, you know, we can spend money and throw more money into this program, but we're never going to achieve the level of safety and economy and efficiency that we had hoped for when the program started out. And it's going to take a lot of courage for someone within NASA to stand up and say that, but I think the record speaks for itself, even if no leader has stood up and said the shuttle has serious problems.
You know, on the Tuesday night space show this week, Gene Kranz was a guest, and I urge all of you who have the History Channel on your television to watch his show tonight. Check your local times. It's a two-hour special called Failure is Not an Option. So first, I have seen the show. The History Channel sent me an advanced copy before Gene came on my program, and this is a phenomenal program. But if for all of you who aren't really quite grasping what Jim is saying about a culture then and what is going on within NASA now, you will see it on this show, because a lot of the mission control and flight directors are part of this special on the History Channel, and they talk about how they dealt with problems that were almost on every flight, even if the press didn't know about it, and how they resolved these issues and the kinds of changes that they made when something went wrong and they realized that their systems weren't working, and the kind of leadership that Gene and the others brought to this group of really 22, 23, 24-year-old engineers and scientists with only bachelor's degrees. That's who was running our space program back then.
NASA was, when Gene Kranz was a younger man, still looks great with that haircut. I love it.
Absolutely. And he talks
great. I would
look
like an idiot with that haircut, but he's one of those guys that it's just natural.
He's 70 years old, he told me.
Yeah, NASA was new, it was fresh, and it was an innovative model for project management. And as you know, having your business management background, NASA has often been the model that other organizations tried to emulate, the NASA of Apollo. And in those days, as large as NASA became, even with those 410,000 folks from the government and industry, the philosophy of NASA was that of what you may recall, David, from your organizational analysis and design classes, a flat organization. In a flat organization, the middle managers would never hesitate to pick up the phone or go knock on a door to point out issues to top management regarding safety or something they were truly concerned about. That's exactly how the lunar orbit rendezvous method came to be used for Apollo. It was a lower level guy who brought that up to upper management, that the only way to get to the moon and back safely by 1969 was not to do Earth orbit rendezvous or direct ascent. I think what we see now in NASA today is almost the opposite of a flat organization. It's what we call a hierarchical pyramid. And this is the classic technocratic, autocratic organization where the bosses are clearly in total command. They sit on top of the pyramid, and the people on each layer of the organization below them work in daily fear of the people who are, one story above them in the pyramid. And communications get suppressed. And so these engineers who were emailing back and forth about, their engineering, their educated speculation about the implications of the TPS impact, their communications never made it to the top of the NASA pyramid. It got stopped, basically because people feel intimidated. Now, there are other issues outside of NASA with contractors, particularly United Space Alliance, and we'll get into that when we talk about Gunter Vent, because Gunter has some strong feelings about the incentives that United Space Alliance receives for on-time launches. And I think we've seen some hints that this may be mentioned in the CABE report when it comes out. But we'll get to that a little later on. Basically, though, NASA finally grew to suffer some of the problems that the aerospace contractors who built Apollo were already suffering within their own internal organization by 1969. I think it was Reeser in 1969, a researcher who surveyed managers in aerospace companies, and he wanted to know about some of the human problems of project organization in the aerospace industry. And he got responses, I think, from 8 companies, and 6 of those companies, the problems related to structural ambiguities and anxiety related to eventual phase-out of the projects, because aerospace projects tend to be short-lived, and even in the shuttle program, contractors, when times are bad, they will lay people off, they will transfer people to other projects. So there's confusion sometimes also, the member says, who their boss actually is, who they're supposed to report to, and who they're supposed to take orders from, and who they're supposed to impress in order to get promoted. There's also a low sense of employee loyalty because of those frequent transfers between projects and organizations. Engineers in all fields, whether it's construction or whatever, there's so much job mobility. A large corporation, engineering corporation, will win a contract that's good for 5 years. It doesn't have to be aerospace. They could be building a new sports stadium or an irrigation project or whatever, and that job's going to last 5 years. Basically, all engineers are similar to contract programmers, and so they're always worried about where they're going to land next. There's also a lack of clarity in job definitions, authority relationships, lines of communication, random and unplanned personal development because of the short time under any one manager, and intense competition for resources, recognition, and rewards. These have been identified as problems in the aerospace industry, and perhaps because NASA, like a lot of other government agencies, turned to outsourcing and actually bringing contractors in directly on the processes rather than just supplying, say, a third stage booster for a Saturn V or supplying the lunar module. United Space Alliance actually runs shuttle processing and launch operations. And so perhaps because of that, the operators of our national space vehicle or space transportation system have inherited some of these problems that have long existed in the aerospace industry.
Where coming up on our break in just a minute, but let me see if I can get this question in from Donald in San Diego, who sent it in by email, because I believe it's appropriate at this point. And he says, it's interesting to talk about possible changes within NASA as a result of the findings of the CAIB report. What about holding any of the NASA or U.S. Space Alliance personnel accountable for what they did or did not do, including NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe? After all, the buck stops with him. It happened on his watch. Donald, San Diego.
Well, Sean O'Keefe, of course, is an appointee of the present administration in the White House, so it's unlikely responsibility will climb that high. He had not been on the job very long either, and he doesn't really have a professional background in the space program. He came from the Office of Management and Budget, but of course, so did James Webb had a budget office background before he came to NASA, so those guys can either be very excellent NASA administrators, or in other cases we've seen NASA people should run and duck and cover when they see a budget guy coming into command. But following the Apollo 204 fire in 1967 and following Challenger, about the most severe punishment people got was being transferred to do-nothing jobs or jobs where they could do no harm, or maybe receive early retirement. And I expect we'll see a repeat of that, because there's a reluctance to fire people for whatever reason. And we've already seen some rather vicious attacks from the media and from people making comments in the media about Linda Hamm and her role in the decision not to seek the military spy imaging of the damage to Columbia's wing. And I tend to think that these problems are systemic, they're institutional, and perhaps we shouldn't focus on the behavior of individuals, because the space shuttle program has gone on so long that the experience and the knowledge that was gained through the Challenger tragedy has largely just been lost. It's no longer in the institutional memory. And we see the same people who are equally as qualified and dedicated as Gene Kranz and the Apollo team, they're having to learn these lessons all over again. And unfortunately, spaceflight is a very dangerous business. And our oversights and our mistakes, I'm not saying there were any oversights that were in, you know, we should hold someone accountable for, but mistakes are deadly in this business. And so NASA needs to find a way to retain that experience and that knowledge, that institutional memory that's so vital to keeping the space program viable and, of course, funded. Because I don't think the American people want to see more of these tragedies. I'm impressed that opinion polls indicate that the American public still thinks space is important, and President Bush echoed those feelings in a statement this weekend. He feels like the space program is important, but I think we should demand more out of our National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
It's a good point to take our break. Everybody, stay right where you are. We will be back in 2 minutes with our guest.
The Space Show would like to take a moment to thank each of you for listening and giving this program both praise and support. The Space Show, like other talk radio programs, depends upon advertisers and sponsors for their help and financial support. Tell your favorite business about the great advertising opportunities still available on The Space Show. Our ad packages are affordable, creative, and effective. They include web links and advertising, streaming internet play, as well as our very own internet radio station, in combination with your ad, on the Tuesday evening KKNW Seattle Space Show broadcast. Ad packages can be customized to fit your budget, and we know that we can have a positive impact on your business. For more information about advertising or sponsoring The Space Show, call Dr. Livingston at 415-435-6018 or send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show. and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
Welcome back, everyone. This is the host of the Space Show, David Livingston. Our guest today is Jim McDade, and we are talking about the upcoming report about NASA and the Columbia accident tragedy. Just reminders, you can call toll-free, and our lines are open at 1-866-687-7223. Email, again, is drspace@thespaceshow.com or dmlivings@yahoo.com, and our chat screen name is Space Show Chat. Jim, I do have a quick email question from Mason, who is listening in Hershey, Pennsylvania. He says, what does your guest think the program should be for the space shuttle? Should it be kept flying? Should we go with NASA's version of the orbital space plane? Or do you think it's time to let the private sector handle space access to LEO?
Well, unfortunately, the space shuttle program at this juncture recalls memories of Vietnam and other international commitments America has made that it just could not easily pull itself out of. The International Space Station is a multi-billion dollar international project, and there are quite a few nations who are depending on the United States to keep the space shuttle flying so that this international project can keep going. We don't have an alternative vehicle. Of course, the Russians can fly their Soyuz variants up there and supply the space station, and we can possibly keep two or three people going up there, but the shuttle depends, or the International Space Station depends on the shuttle for crew rotation and for installation of the future modules that will be added to the space station. We have got to keep the shuttle flying as long as we keep the International Space Station going. We don't have time to end the shuttle today and turn around and develop a new spacecraft that can replace the space shuttle. So, but what we need, I think, is a definite timetable. Just like President John F. Kennedy told NASA, gave them the orders, this is your mission. Fly people to the moon and return them safely to Earth by the end of this decade. NASA did that in about 8.5 years. We need strong leadership and unity between the White House and Congress that crosses party lines and petty politics. NASA needs to be given a target, because I don't think all of the problems with NASA are NASA's fault. The agency has lacked a clear sense of direction and mission for a long time. And President George W. Bush, or if one of his friends are listening, they need to take this seriously, because this is a major part of our national investment and our future. President Bush said the space program is important, but it's not just important. It's critical to our future. No civilization that's ever withdrawn from exploration has survived very long after withdrawing. The Chinese are out there waiting to compete for the space resources. The European Space Agency is launching satellites. It's a lucrative business, trillions of dollars. The global positioning system gives the United States a strategic economic and military and all sorts of advantages. Without the global positioning system, the Russians or the Europeans would have put up a system that they could have sold to the world. But right now, all of the world economies beat to the pulse rate of the United States, the global positioning system. They track cargo shipments and the world markets. They're all in sync with the global positioning system. James Oberg did a wonderful presentation about this, and I can't give too many details of James's article because I think it's going to be published before too long, but the GPS is something that we do not appreciate fully. I think we're committed to the shuttle, but there needs to be a definitive end date to the program, and there needs to be a definitive start date for the next generation vehicle. I asked Fred Gregory about the orbital space plane, and the problem is that word, orbital space plane, is causing people some pain and some gnashing of teeth. And Gregory advised, don't assume because the word plane is in orbital space plane that this new vehicle is going to have wings. That's basically just a working project title. So he says, who knows, it may end up being more like an Apollo, big Apollo capsule, or it might be something completely different that, lifting body technology or whatever. But he said not to assume that this vehicle will have wings. But the Congress and the White House need to assure that NASA has the funding to go ahead and show us what this new next-generation vehicle looks like and give us a timetable when we can expect it to fly. And they don't need to be chipping away at the budget every physical year the way they did with Shuttle. The configuration of the Shuttle was altered and compromised. It's not the military's fault that they were forced into bed with NASA on the Space Shuttle, which resulted in a compromise of the design. The Shuttle ended up being unsuitable for both the Air Force's needs and NASA's needs. It didn't have the economic viability that NASA needed in order to have cheap access to space, and it did not have all of the capabilities that the military needed. And the Pentagon also griped about the expense of the Shuttle. So we definitely need some hard targets for NASA to aim at.
What about the private sector and access to LEO?
The private sector, there are certain roles that government has to play simply because certain enterprises are too large, private enterprise. That doesn't mean that private enterprise should not be encouraged and given tax incentives, and private enterprise should have access to all of the non-national security-related research that's available. But as you know, the great voyages of exploration, Magellan, Cook, Columbus, they were all government-funded. Lewis and Clark, the three ages of Western exploration were all funded by government simply because the job is too large for private enterprise to handle. Now, it's the job of government to do the initial exploration and development to facilitate the entry of private enterprise and private interest into those areas. Space is no different from any other frontier. If you look at the planet Mars, for example, that's where Zubrin and so many people want to go next. But you've got to realize the best, most hospitable, good weather day on Mars is going to be a lot harsher than the worst day at the South Pole. We're going to have to develop new technologies and new methods, and it's only the government can afford to prototype the systems that are going to be necessary to habitat or eventually terraform Mars. The same with the moon. Fortunately, the moon's only 3 days away, so I think it's much more likely that some private enterprise group, if we ever make progress in the area of, say, helium-3 fusion, you could easily send robotic craft to harvest the helium-3 deposits on the lunar surface and bring it back to Earth for research and for power generation. But at this point, it's still a task that's up to the government. Recall that it was more than a century after Columbus, he didn't really discover America, but he bumped into it as far as the Europeans were concerned, and it opened the new world to their eyes. It was well over a century before you had the first European colony established in America, or settlement. So, you know, we tend to think in terms of our short lifetime. We want things done now. We want that private enterprise up in space, and we want the hotel in orbit. We want it now. But opening up and taming a new frontier is something that takes 100 years or more, with space maybe much more than 100 years. So we need to be thinking in terms of our children and our children's children and the long-term survival and quality of life for all of our descendants. And it's incumbent upon us, you know, and I tell this to adult groups all the time that I speak to about space. If you really love your children, there are a lot of reasons for you to support space exploration. It's going to be a key part of their future. And then, of course, there are threats like rogue asteroids. If we ever do, unfortunately, face that long shot odd of a mass extinction collision with an asteroid or comet, we better be prepared. It's up to us to develop now the technology, the propulsion systems, and the other systems that would be used to divert the path of that comet or asteroid years before it actually comes here for impact, because it's going to take very long-range planning. And
absolutely.
The entire future of this planet is dependent on what we do now, that we have the technology for space exploration in our hands. And it's no coincidence, David, that Apollo 11 happened at a point in the history of technology, in the history of humanity, that we had the tools and the ability to put that system together and go to the moon. You know, exploration is wired into human beings. That spirit of exploration. And it's, I believe that it's part of our survival instinct. There's an imperative that's bigger than economics or private enterprise or our government quest for territorial domination. I think it's something that starts with each individual human being. It's not just a societal or enterprise sort of thing. And I wish that our political leaders that we place our trust in would appreciate that more than they apparently do.
Well, that is true. In the last half of the show, let's get in and hear what Harrison Schmidt and Gunther told you. We'd all like to hear some of those comments.
Of course, they are legends of the space program, and in their day, they were heroes that we all looked up to. We saw glances of them in the documentaries and in the live coverage of Apollo 17 and all of the golden age of space missions. Gunther Wendt was there assuring crew safety. He was the pad leader, and that's a great book if you haven't read it about Gunther. There was a report in the Washington Post recently written by R. Jeffrey Smith. And quoting, he said, members of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board say their report will take sharp issue with NASA's persistent view that the accident was caused only by poor data, specifically a bad computer model of the impact of debris on the wing. Instead, the CAB will say the calamity was also the result of a string of managerial blunders and defects that must not recur. Well, Wendt and Schmidt have been reading these reports. Let me read something to you. This is from an accident investigation report, and the recommendations are review shuttle management structure, placing more authority with the program manager. Review critical shuttle parts and systems, those which, if they failed, could result in loss of the vehicle and or life. Another recommendation, create a semi-independent safety, reliability, and quality assurance directorate within NASA, reporting directly to the NASA administrator. Improve communications. Take steps to improve landing safety. Try to implement a crew escape system usable during controlled gliding flight. Establish a shuttle flight rate consistent with available resources. And improve shuttle maintenance standards. Do you know where these statements come from, David?
I hesitate to venture a guess, but certainly not from Columbia long before that.
June 6, 1986, the Rogers Commission STS-51
on the Challenger
report. Those were the recommendations issued by the equivalent of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board for Challenger. From what we've seen so far, the CABE report coming out Tuesday sounds like an instant replay, many parts of it. And as I asked Richard Covey a couple of weeks ago, why didn't you guys fix these problems the first time? It appears that the Rogers Commission identified many of these management issues and many of these safety issues, and perhaps things were done for a while to improve that situation, but as I pointed out before, the institutional memory of NASA apparently is very short, and that issue needs to be addressed. I received an email from Harrison Schmidt on August 19th, and Schmidt, I'll quote here, said, the common thread in the three worst accidents of NASA history, Apollo 204, Shuttle Challenger, and Columbia, is the managerial acceptance of the technically abnormal as operationally normal. These are the so-called exceptions that Gunter is going to talk about in a minute when I quote him, the waivers, the 1,200 waivers that have to be signed in order for the shuttle to fly every mission. Schmidt said the engineering information of a potential problem was available in each of the fatal cases. Management at the action level ignored its implications. He also points out that another one of the common threads was the lack of technological experience at the senior levels in NASA that led to little or no competent oversight of the second-level managers. And he could also not help be struck by the apparent lack of a diligent, no-holds-barred look at this indication of a foam strike by the mission control team, and thus a look at confirmation options and potential rescue scenarios. And this is where Schmidt refers to an offline team response. He says an offline team response to a flight anomaly, no matter how apparently minor, as it was thought this foam debris strike was, that sort of offline team response was a routine occurrence during Apollo, and probably he thinks it was the routine response during the early shuttle flights when a lot of those Apollo veterans were still around the agency. And Schmidt basically believes that these problems are systemic, that we shouldn't necessarily be picking out individuals and nailing them to a cross or running them out of town on a rail. Schmidt had some rather harsh comments. He said during the golden years, these problems were exacerbated by the loss of disciplined program, risk, and financial management systems readily apparent in the troubles of the International Space Station, the X-33, and several planetary missions. So he directly mentions Dan Golden's administration of NASA, and that's a pretty damning remark right there. He claims that there is lack of NASA infrastructure, of internal parallel engineering, and the agency's willingness to take on underfunded projects as, you know, reasons for the decline of the shuttle program to the point where it is now. And that began, as I've pointed out in my article, Space Shuttle Blues, from the very beginning, when James Fletcher was administrator of NASA. He repeatedly agreed to budget reductions, funding reductions for development of the shuttle. And that is a fatal flaw in the shuttle program, and we can't really rebuild the shuttle from scratch. And I think that's why we need to do everything we can possibly, can humanly do to assure that the shuttle is safe. But we also need to figure out when and how to put the shuttle out of service and replace it with a vehicle that is not designed with the limitations that were built into the shuttle because of those funding reductions.
What should we do with United Space Alliance? And maybe we should back up, and for listeners who don't know the history of United Space Alliance, what happened, how it got created, and I guess a lot of people may think that NASA still maintains and operates and takes care of the shuttle, but that is not the case anymore. Do you want to give us a little bit of a 101 on the background of this?
Well, it's typical of what's gone on with a lot of government agencies. And I suppose that trend started with the United States Postal Service when there was an effort to either privatize or to create quasi-government or contractor-run programs to do work that used to be done by civil service, government employees, or even the military. As you probably know, being a Navy veteran, administration of a lot of Naval, Air Force, Army, Marine facilities, a lot of times the equivalent of what used to be the base commander is a civilian, and there are a lot of civilians in the workforce on military bases.
Absolutely.
This is pervasive throughout government. And, of course, the problem is usually you can identify problems that are going to occur in the long term due to the nature of the contracts that are signed. Gunter Vint pointed this out, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But the problem is, the fundamental problem with outsourcing something as critical as space shuttle operations is that companies have to make a profit in order to survive. And that doesn't make them automatically evil. I've never been one of those people that assumes every corporation is evil just because it has a profit motive. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to make money, but there are a lot of things that can go wrong with that process when it comes to the government awarding contracts. One of those problems is underbidding. And the willingness for corporations to underbid or to, well, let me define underbidding. It's when the government announces a request for proposals, an RFP document, say to build a space shuttle. The government wants to see the prototypes, the drawings, the research that a contractor has done to supply the product or service that they're looking for, and they want to have cost projections. How much is this going to cost us? And there's the old jokes from the Wright stuff and other movies about the spacecraft being built by the lowest bidder. Well, what underbidding is when a contractor either knowingly or unwittingly, because of ignorance or bad cost-benefit studies, submits a proposal that is absurdly too low. And there are also problems with something that's called cost-plus contracts. And when the American economy was so strong in the 1950s and 1960s, these sort of underbidding and cost-plus contracts were not that big an issue because the United States was flush with wealth. Europe, the United States' main economic competitor, Europe, was still having to spend a lot of its resources on rebuilding after the destruction of World War II. The Japanese were not yet the viable, powerful economy that they became. So we were able to always give a cost-of-living adjustment, a raise, a supplemental contract to help these underbidding contractors meet their objective. Now, beginning in the early 1970s, when inflation began to rise, there were money supply issues, and the economy began to get shaky, it became much more difficult for the government to give supplemental monies to projects like the space shuttle. So the contractors were told, and this actually happened. George Shultz, who's been in the news recently, went to James Fletcher, the administrator of NASA, and Fletcher had assumed that the space shuttle program was going to have he had already accepted a drastically reduced budget of $5.2 billion, with a contingency funding of 20% for cost overruns. Well, Shultz went to Fletcher and said, no, you can't have that 20%. It's absolutely out of the question. Well, what that forces is your underbidding contractor or your contractor who actually had a well-worked-out bid learns that he's not going to have any wiggle room at all to play with cost. If the cost of certain raw materials goes up, that contractor is going to have to eat that cost. They can't spend more money than they bring in for that contract, because they would have to fire people or disappoint stockholders or whatever. There are a lot of disincentives for doing that. So what do? They cut corners. They go out and buy alternate materials that might not meet the quality standards that you had hoped for. This happened repeatedly with the space shuttle program. Features and capabilities that the original conceivers of the space shuttle concept had were just set aside because there simply wasn't enough money to have a crew escape system, a viable crew escape system. There wasn't enough money to use the chemically pressurized liquid fuel engines that Wernher von Braun had envisioned for the space shuttle. So they had to use the solid rocket boosters, and the Air Force added its huge drop tank, the external tank, onto the shuttle stack. And the program bore little or no similarity to the original concept that went all the way back to the 1950s for a space shuttle or space truck. So it's a very sad legacy, our space shuttle, and as I say, I think it's time to go ahead and put a termination date on the program and make every effort, spend whatever money is necessary. If NASA needs $20 billion for 5 years, we may not be able to afford as many wars, but as John Kennedy said, you know, if we're not going to do it right, we might as well not do it at all, and we might as well let some other nation take over the planet.
Well, we've got U.S. Space Alliance, which is a joint venture with Boeing and Lockheed, managing the shuttle. They get bonus incentives of cash every time the damn thing flies on schedule. What
it's
can you say about all of this?
Because when I spoke to Gunter Vent this afternoon, and I asked Gunter if he felt that this STS-107 tragedy was similar to the Challenger accident, and he said, it is the same damn thing all over. That's exactly what he said. He said the incident share, the Challenger and Columbia incident share a common management response. Quoting him, he said, manager said, we have a problem, but then nothing happened. The manager saw the foam strike the wing. They had that video. And he said their attitude was, well, we've noted that shuttle management had seen impacts from the orbiter and the foam impacts in the past from the thermal protection system of the external tank, and their response amounted to, this is the response of the NASA managers according to Gunter, nothing happened before when foam struck the orbiter, so things should be okay this time. It was just the same damn thing, Gunter kept repeating. He's pretty angry about this. He said it's the same thing as Challenger with the SRB field joint rotation problem, which was, as you know, a well-known, a documented issue. Yet the shuttle had, you know, launched numerous times with those defective field joints and nothing went wrong. So back in January of 1986, they decided to launch it one more time, even though the weather required a waiver and it took quite a bit of maneuvering in order, you know, the shuttle was launched over the objection of the manufacturer of the solid rocket booster. It was amazing. Wynn also pointed out some of the absurdities in NASA's previous safety and quality rules, the so-called Rule of Seven. And that's where each top manager maintains his pay grade by having seven people report to him directly. In other words, he has seven underlings. And Wendt claims that in some of the cases, those seven underlings under an engineer or manager might not do anything but read books or do other non-substantial things just so that that manager can maintain that span of seven people underneath him in order to stay in that pay classification.
That's absurd.
Yeah. Wendt also pointed out that in his day, when things were done right at NASA, it usually required two signatures to approve certain items or hardware for flight. Sometimes it might be his signature and a contractor's signature, that the representative for the manufacturer or the contractor providing the service or product would sign off saying this product is okay. Gunter or the NASA receiving person would inspect it and put their signature on it. So you had one signature from NASA and one signature from the contract supplier. Gunter told me that after Challenger, it was required to have six or maybe even seven signatures on every item, and he said the problem with this procedure is that it assumes that a quantity of signatures, a number of signatures, implies higher quality than just two signatures. And he says, Wynn says what can happen in that case is that the second, third, and fourth, and so on guys who sign off think, well, the guy who signed off it before me probably knows more than me. He studied this issue and he signed it off, so I trust him. You know, this item must be okay, so I'll sign off too. Or they might think that the person who signs it after them will catch something that they might miss. So it's just absurd that anybody would, you know, conceive of something like that as a safety measure, because, as you know, phenomena such as groupthink, an identifiable behavioral problem in organizations, you know, everybody starts thinking and acting the same way and assuming that the person ahead of them and the person behind them is doing their job. So you have a chain of bad decisions. Now, you mentioned the launch incentive that the United Space Alliance has. Wynn strongly questions that, and he says it's a $1 million incentive that the shuttle operations contractor receives for on-time launches. And he points out that an engineer or manager representing USA might consciously or unconsciously feel pressured, you know, to certify his part of the system for flight, since they are aware that a $1 million bonus is on the line for their company. Woe be to the manager who holds up a launch because of some concern that might or might not be legitimate, because, not being a government or NASA employee, it's, you know, very easy for a corporation like Boeing to just fire a guy because he makes a decision they don't like. Overall, Wynn thinks that launch incentive puts too much pressure on these guys to sign off a vehicle that's ready for launch. In my opinion, I think a launch incentive should not be awarded because of an on-time launch. If they want to have, you know, contractor incentives for the space shuttle, pay them $1 million every time the little shuttle lands safely and brings a crew back. Put pressure on them to perform quality-wise, you know, not schedule-wise. I would rather just have one or two safe space missions a year than seven or eight, you know, risky missions that launched on time.
Absolutely.
And it's a matter of priorities and deciding what to emphasize. NASA has always been sensitive about the shortcomings in the on-time launchability of the shuttle. And as things stand now, you know, the initially announced shuttle launch time and dates are usually about as reliable as the Florida weather. It's about 2/3 of shuttles will launch on schedule. That's about it. So there's a real good chance that if you plan your vacation around a shuttle launch, you're not going to see.
I have a question I want to get in.
I got one more comment from Gunter.
Okay.
The last thing he said, he's just astounded that the shuttle is flying with 1,200 waivers, or what he refers to as exceptions. Some of these are, you know, are minor safety issues or engineering or technical issues, but it just bothers him. Gunter was a quality control freak when he ran when he was the pad leader at KSC. He also had go-no-go authority for the launches. Now, you talk about a guy, I mean, this is the hard hat guy on the launch pad, but if he didn't feel that spacecraft was ready for flight, he could pick up the phone and say, you know, don't launch this thing. And he told me that even if he felt like he would be fired for holding up a launch, he cared that much about those men that he knew very personally in those days, and later women too in the space shuttle program, he was not going to put their life at risk unnecessarily. For example, do you recall the incident where Wally Schirra, Gemini 6, the Titan launch vehicle, got down to T-minus zero, and there was a little bit of noise, and the pumps were running, but then it shut down.
Right.
And Wally Schirra was up there nervous. Actually, he was a calm, cool, collected astronaut. We won't say he was nervous, but he had the option of hitting the ejection seat and basically destroying the spacecraft and scrubbing the mission, but he courageously held on. Now, Gunter Wendt and his crew, you know, after that incident, occurred, they immediately went to the pad and started safing the systems. Now, those ejection seats that Wally Schirra had his hand on the eject handle, they had 15 safety pins that had to be removed before flight so that they could, that they would work, that the astronaut would eject. Gunter and his pad crew had some special pouches, and there were holes or compartments in these pouches, and each one of those 15 pins had to be in its place, and he would count and inspect, you know, the places where those pins were supposed to be before and after flight. So he made, before they got the crew out of there, he made sure every one of those safety pins were in place. That's how thorough this guy was. He didn't care how long it took him to do the job, as long as the job was done correctly. So it was quality over quantity over those days, and it really didn't matter to the agency as much to the managers around those days that they launched on time, because I think most of the NASA people in those days recognized that the space program, for public relations reasons and for personal caring, you know, NASA family reasons, they didn't want to lose astronauts. And we pretty much know from the Apollo fire, NASA was partially responsible for that. There was a lapse in management at that point, but North American Aviation had all kinds of problems with its workers, alcoholism and allegations of drug abuse and just sloppiness and shoddiness. In fact, the Apollo 1 investigation report cited the fact that there was a shocking level of drunkenness among the workers at the Downey North American plant. And they sent Frank Borman out, you know, Mr. Straight-Laced Frank Borman, to set them straight. And there were no more drinking problems. And, of course, we never had another Apollo spacecraft kill an astronaut, but North America was harshly criticized for ignorance, sloth, and carelessness. Those are words directly from the Apollo 1 fire report concerning the North American Downey plant that built that deadly Apollo spacecraft that killed Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. But I would hope that the people who are responsible for the safety of our astronauts today, are striving to be as conscientious and effective as Gunter Wendt.
Let me get this question in from Sandra in Reno, because it's probably something that's on the mind of a lot of listeners. She wants to know, will the CABE address the possibility of having rescued the crew and why this effort was not undertaken? Also, is Mr. McDade hearing anything about any probable or potential response by the Columbia family members, the survivors, to the CABE?
The family members will receive copies of the report. Now, the initial printing, and I'm rather disappointed at this, and I wonder if the CABE is running out of money, but they're only going to print 100 hard copies.
Yeah, I read that, too.
Of the report. So, now, the press conference is at 11 a.m. Tuesday, but you can go ahead and download an Adobe Acrobat, a PDF file, copy of the report beginning at 10 a.m. on the CABE website. So it's 250 pages. You'll want to download it, and it's going to be hard to read 250 pages in an hour before the press conference, but maybe you can hit the highlights. The families have shown extraordinary restraint, in my opinion, and support for NASA, because basically they are part of the NASA family, you know, literally and spiritually. I don't think they want to single out individuals in this case. Bitterness may come later on, and they may think, well, you know, why couldn't so-and-so have made this decision or that decision? But I think they still feel like they're part of the team, because their loved ones who died aboard Columbia understood the risk and the rewards of being an astronaut, of being a scientist or being a pilot astronaut or a mission specialist. And I feel pretty confident that especially the husbands and wives and maybe the sons and daughters and parents got together and talked about this. You know, this is a dangerous profession I'm in. So they've been extraordinarily benevolent and benign and understanding in these circumstances. I don't know, you know, some of the things I've read, I don't know if I could be as restrained as some of those wonderful people have been.
What about the first part of Sandra's question about addressing any crew rescue possibilities?
That will most definitely be addressed by the CABE and most definitely addressed in Congress, because the fact that it was just basically considered impossible, and of course it would have been very risky to have prepared Atlantis hurriedly and rushed it out to the pad, but when we look at that already released CABE recommendation that NASA seek to ascertain imaging of the reinforced carbon-carbon panels as early in the mission impossible, indicates that perhaps if NASA had obtained those images, and you got to realize that even with these high-resolution cameras, you're talking about a cavity or a hole in a dark gray crevice on that wing under maybe not ideal lighting conditions. It may have been difficult to see a hole the size of a dinner plate, which is what most people think the hole was the size of in Columbia's wing. But if they at least made the effort and we had been aware, NASA and maybe even the public had been aware that Columbia was doomed, we still would not have known what happened. We would have looked at the video and said, well, the hole must have been caused, you know, intuitively would think, but there wouldn't have been a lot of time to do the extensive sort of investigation that was done by the CAIB. So it would have been very risky to have launched another crew up there to attempt a very few attempt, because there has never been a rehearsal or a viable plan, you know, to fly two shuttles at once and pick up a crew, rescue a crew from another shuttle. NASA's resources are already strained to the limit for supporting a single shuttle on orbit. So a lot of unprecedented things would have had to have happened and would have had to have been executed perfectly in order to fly that rescue mission. But I think what really irritates people like Harrison Schmitt, Gunter Wendt, and the people who were around, or even people who've just seen the Apollo 13 movie, what happened to that spirit of never giving up, never quitting, and pursuing even the most remote way out option in order to save your people?
Failure is not an option. Went to failure is an option.
Yes, look at 9/11. Look at the response of the New York Fire Department, the New York Police Department, going into a burning skyscraper that burned the Trade Center towers, totally disregarding personal safety. I don't think you would have had, I believe every astronaut in the astronaut office would have run to the front of the room if they were asked to step forward to volunteer to fly a rescue mission to save that beautiful group of people. I know I personally feel like I would have, even though I'm certainly not qualified. David, you probably do too, and most of the people listening.
All of us would have.
You would have risked your life to save those wonderful people. And I think that is so disappointing that we didn't even begin to evaluate the extent and the seriousness of that TPS foam impact. There was that window of opportunity to request from the Department of Defense to point their surveillance satellites and their ground surveillance equipment at the shuttle. Take a look at that damage. Let's evaluate it. That wasn't done. And I think that is the condemning moment in this incident, and a moment that some people are going to regret for as long as they live.
Absolutely.
And when you look at the decision-making process, there's something that I call McDade's steps that NASA or any leader should take when there is a known event that may or may not have terrible consequences. And this might even be something as simple as a lightning strike on your own house. I've broken it down into a series of steps. First thing you've got to do is gather all of the available information. Examine the situational factors and all available information regarding the particular event or situation. That would be the step that NASA missed. They did not request those images of Columbia's wing. Step two, once you have that information and all the situational factors, you determine what, if any, actions there are that you can take. You need to list all of the possible ways that your organization or your personal self can respond. This would be your Atlantis rescue mission. That would be one of the possibilities. That step involves processing the and gathering information in a determined manner and try to consider even the most remote or wild possibilities. And, of course, the Atlantis rescue mission would have been wild, but like I said, you wouldn't find a shortage of volunteers either in the workforce at United Space Alliance, very dedicated people. They would have worked hard to get Atlantis ready. Step three, you continue processing the information and the possibilities for action until you've narrowed down the action options. You narrow them down to one or more possible causes of actions that are deemed to be advisable, courses of action, one or more possible courses of actions that are deemed to be advisable. This is where the leadership, the managers, have to step in. In step four, the leader or the leaders, the management team, they choose that course of action or response to that known event. Step five, the leaders, the leadership has to authorize the chosen response. They have to orchestrate the people and the hardware, the equipment, the resources, and see to it that the action orders are issued and that they are clearly transmitted and understood. And then finally, step six, that leader must personally verify the execution of that chosen response. You don't hand off responsibility, you know, for something that you've decided to take action on. But if you look through these six steps, it appears the ball was dropped on step one. The failure was in not gathering all of the available information that clearly could have been available. The request could have been made to get those images, and it may be iffy, it may be arguable that the penetration of the TPS foam into the wing, the plate-sized hole or crack or crevice, we can't say definitively that it would have been discovered. But just the fact that the effort was not made, something as simple as a phone call or an email could have initiated a response that could have led to the execution of the other steps, the other five steps.
Jim, you know, we are plumb out of time, and I have a suggestion. I'm going to end up downloading that report, as I'm sure you will, too, and I'm going to go through it, as I'm sure you will. Let's bring you back on board on a special space show. You and I can work out the time, and then I can announce it to everybody. And let's spend some more time really talking about this report and the recommendations and what response has been made public between the time the report comes out and when we do this special programming. Are you up for that?
I am up for that. I would love to do it. I'm going to be, may possibly be up all night reading and analyzing that report, and would love to come on, and I would like to take the CAB's account of the incident and compare it to those six steps that I've written down.
Well,
decision-making process.
Let's do it, and After we download our copies on Tuesday, you and I will talk, and we'll plan the program, and then I'll put out an announcement about it, and we'll go at it, okay?
And one of these days I need to get you on this end of the country to take you up to Huntsville to show you some of the historic facilities, and not just historic facilities, but it's still the place where NASA propulsion research occurs.
I'm ready.
And probably the United States Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville has got to be the finest collection of rocket hardware on the planet. They've got the vertical Saturn V display there. I think you would enjoy that very much. It's nothing like seeing that majestic rocket in the position that it was intended to be, not lying flat.
Yeah, I've seen the lying flat ones. So,
so we need to get you here to Alabama, and I encourage people to email me with their questions directly at jmcdade, J-M-C-D-A-D-E, at uab.edu. And also I want to invite people to join Space ADG, and you can go on the web. That's http://groups.yahoo.com/group/SpaceADG. Now, I realize the people who are listening live will have to go back and replay the end of the program in order to get that URL, but you can also just do a Google search for Space ADG as one word, S-P-A-C-E-A-D-G, and it'll take you there.
Absolutely, and you and I will talk no later than Wednesday of this coming week.
Sounds great, David.
Thank you very much for being on the Sunday Space Show, and everybody, stay tuned for Tuesday's program, and we will be following this up within just a very few days. Have a great week, everyone.